in simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Needless to say, the beast was stunned. A whip crack ripped his rumpet tail, and the beast was done. He asked us, be you angels? And we said, nay, we are but men. Rock
on. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Scotty Roberts right here on the Intrepid Radio program. We are looking for Dr. John Ward. He's out there somewhere. We may or may not have him with us tonight. He was at his, as you know, if you follow us on Sunday nights and you follow the Situation Room on Thursdays, John was talking about being at the archaeological site, Gebel El Silsila, just yesterday with me. And he said that he got news from his house back in Luxor, which is about an hour and a half drive away, that the sandstorms that it hit had taken out their house. Not completely, but had everything was full of sand, and they didn't think they had any electricity, possibly no internet. And he's just messaging me on the hotel, from the little hotel down the street in Luxor. And he's saying to me right now, he says, brother, no internet. Hotel internet does not work. I'm in hell. He just typed that. And so filling in for the sandy Dr. John Ward is going to be our brother-in-arms, Rocky Stucci. Rocky, how you doing tonight?
Man, I'm doing great. And I'm sorry, Scotty. I do remember on the last episode last Thursday that we were cursed from John. He cursed us. He was a pretty deep one, too. So I think this is payback.
I think it is, too. I don't think he can listen to us even, so I don't think he's hearing us. And I would type to him if I wasn't on the radio, but I just said, so sorry.
So sorry.
He said he's in hell. And, yes, folks, if you missed the Situation Room on Thursday, John cursed Rocky and me. He cursed us.
It hurt my feelings, kind of. It really did. It hurt my feelings a little bit.
You know, we came in as lighthearted as brothers come in, and he cursed us in retaliation. So John just said to me, say hello to all my diehard fans sitting here on the Nile watching the kingfishers dive for fish. I am going to say hello to all my fans. So there it is. That's from John Ward. I don't do a perfect John Ward, but I try.
A lot better than he does his southern accent.
Oh, my goodness. If you have never heard John Ward do his southern accent, you don't want to.
No.
There's nothing like a Brit who grew up on the Welsh border trying to do a southern accent. I can't even mimic that one. It's something like, hi, y'all. We're like, what the hell was that, John?
Wait, like, did you fall? You all right?
Yeah. Are you in pain? Rocky, we've got a fantastic guest that's going to be coming on after the bottom of the hour. So don't walk away because you heard me say it's going to be about 20 minutes before he's here, maybe closer to a half an hour. We have Travis Walton. And if you have not read the book, you may have seen the movie that came out. Gosh, what was it, almost 10 years ago now?
Yeah.
Who was the guy who played in that movie? It'll come to me in a second. The movie was Fire in the Sky. Travis has his own book, Fire in the Sky. I believe he wrote this after the movie, if I'm not mistaken, called Fire in the Sky, The Walton Experience, the best documented case of alien abduction ever recorded. It's an interesting story. It took place in the mid-1970s. Rocky, if you remember this, you remember the movie probably, and I think you probably read some stuff about this and heard about it over the years. Travis was a logger. And they were logging up in, I believe, in northern Arizona. They saw a UFO, and Travis got out of the car and looked at it and disappeared. As a matter of fact, I could go over to his official site, and we'll lead up to this. Here are the witnesses that had some. These are all the guys that were with him. Michael Rogers, Alan Dallas, John Goulet, Kenneth Peterson, Steve Pierce, Dwayne Smith. These were all the loggers that were with him. And these are the one-liners they gave for the experience. First of all, Travis himself said, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't even get out of the truck. In 1975, Michael Rogers said, I've been working these woods for over 10 years, and this is the damnedest thing that ever happened to me. And in 1995, 20 years later, he said, I've been working these woods for over 30 years, and this still is the damnedest thing that ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. Alan Dulles said, we couldn't believe what was happening. The horror was unreal. John Goulet, I know what I saw, and it wasn't anything from this earth. Kenneth Peterson, I saw a bluish light come from the machine, and Travis went flying like he'd touched a live wire. Steve Pierce said, that ray was the brightest thing I've ever seen in my whole life. And Dwayne Smith said the UFO was smooth. It was giving off a yellowish-orange glow. So these are some of the quotes from the guys that were with him the night that happened. And if you remember, he was gone. And we'll have Travis telling us all of this stuff firsthand here in just a little bit. He was gone for like 4 or 5 days. And these friends of his were all being investigated in that short period of time. They thought they murdered him. All kinds of stuff like that was going on. And then Travis just shows up on the street. And in the movie, he was naked. I'm not sure if he was naked or not, but they find him hunched over by, like at a gas station, a closed down gas station or something. He maintained silence for a long time after this. He did the polygraph tests and all of that. And we'll let Travis talk about that when he's here.
Could you imagine that? Me, you, and John, you know, we're just kind of cruising around the woods, you know, checking out trees. And we see something, and John's curiosity.
John would say, is that a bear? John saw his first bear when he was up here.
And he was mad at us.
And he was mad at us.
He did. He got mad at us because we didn't want to pull over and take a pic. We see bears all the time.
Take a picture. And we're said, John's just a bear.
He didn't talk to us for like 20 minutes.
I know. He was fuming with us. Anyway, yeah, I see where you're going with that. If we're all driving out in the woods and it was one of the three of us, and Rocky goes, what the hell is that light? That's my best Rocky impression.
Right, you're looking at me light. Don't come near me light, huh?
Get out of the truck and look at it. And there goes Rocky. I couldn't imagine. I think his friends just tore off. They were so afraid of what happened.
But I can see that, though. I mean, if you did see that, if you were in the truck, Scott, and you seen one of us or somebody you knew get out of the truck, because people are curious. We have that curiosity where we go towards the problem instead of away from it. But to see something happen like that, I would probably split. I'm being serious. I would probably, that would be a very frightening experience.
One of us would be back there waving, Rocky, stop! I remember, folks, if you remember, we played it a couple of times, but when we were doing an investigation at the Fernhill house and we heard the big bang and we went running up the stairs, you hear Rocky going, wait.
They were leaving me by myself down on the, I was sitting down on the floor and they're already halfway up the stairs. I didn't want to be left alone. I did. I told him to stop and wait for me, man.
And we were like, it's upstairs. Let's go see it. You know, we make light of it. And it's kind of fun. But this one thing I find about Travis, and we've heard a lot of stories like this. You hear these abduction stories and these UFO stories and even ghost stories. And there are times where you say, that guy sounds like a doofus. And you say, and right away you're skeptical of the story because you're skeptical of the person, or either the way they're presenting something or they don't come across as credible. One thing I can say about Travis, I met him for the first time back in 2011 in Taos, New Mexico. We were at a conference together. One thing that came across to me about Travis Walton was he was a very credible man, very humble man. And he's somebody that really walked away from this whole thing for a long time and didn't say a whole lot about it, although I think he was on the radar of people. And it wasn't until he wrote Fire in the Sky that he said, I'm stepping out and I'm going to finally, and we'll let him talk about why he waited so long to do that. You'll notice he's kind of a quiet guy. He can talk well, but he's quiet, he's humble, and I think very credible. Which to me, and Rocky, you tell me your experience with this, when I hear fantastical stories within the paranormal or anything else, I may doubt the story, and when I'm doubting the story, I'll go to the person and I'll look at the person and say, is this person credible? Do they have a credible character? What is their character in life like in general? And if they're a credible person, I generally say, I think I'll buy his story because he's credible.
I think the individual does have a lot to do with it because we are over. I mean, great example. Just go to YouTube and type in paranormal or type in ghost. 99% of what you see is unbelievable. And when you hear stories like this or these experiences that some of these people have, how much of it is a story and how much of it is reality? That's where you need to Where do you cut the line in the sand is what's real and what's not. And I think you're right, Scotty. I think the individual credibility has a lot to do with it.
And absolutely. I would get that all the time when I worked as the editor-in-chief of Taps Paramag, which is the Ghost Hunters from Sci-Fi, their magazine. I would have a lot of people asking me questions about, well, what do you really think about the collar tug and stuff like that? And I don't really know all the information behind that, but I know I asked Grant, and Grant and I were... I'd say we were pretty good friends. Jason and I never got really tight. Grant Wilson and I got to know each other pretty well, and his wife pretty well. I deemed him to be a very credible person. If they had faked anything on that show, I would think Grant wouldn't have been able to live with himself. He's that kind of a person. And some have said, well, maybe that's why he left the show. He just couldn't live with that. I'm not quite sure. I found Grant because of the kind of person he was. He was a very religious man of faith. He just came across to me as being someone who was genuine about what he was doing. And he was very frustrated with the things that producers would do on that show. I think his story was credible. So I tended to believe his version of events rather than the criticism. Because, as you know, Rocky, and John knows, and everybody out there knows, all of that stuff garners so much criticism from people who just have nothing better to do than we want to criticize somebody who's making science look bad. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and by the way, and Rocky, this is one of the things I have found with the criticism I get and John gets and people we know get in these fields. It's all because there are the watchdogs out there who believe that they need to protect people from the false junk, bunk science that we're trying to pass off. And so they like to criticize. So the critics are, they're many in number.
I'm sorry. So. I don't mean to come off as being negative when I say this, but usually the majority of these critics are the ones sitting in the basement judging and making their determinations off of articles that they read. They have not, and some of them have, but not a lot of them actually gone out in the field to have these experiences. And I can speak for you, and I'm going to speak for me, and I'll speak for others, is that we've all had experiences that it cannot be explained. And so that's why when we have these experiences, it's hard for me to even think or consider or to react to what some of these people are saying when they're criticizing our field of study.
Yes. And that's it. You know, and a lot of that criticism is usually criticism that comes with its own inherent bias. When you are working in the paranormal field, you know, that's almost become, and you've all heard me say this before, the paranormal field, or at least the community, has almost become a comic book of itself. It's so, I know you get this in every field. You get it, you got it in advertising where I work. You get it in scientific fields where, you know, scientists are like, oh, that Dr. So-and-so is simply an ass, you know, and, you know, it's everywhere. In the paranormal field, I have found, and I've said it before, that it just looks like they are cannibalistic. They just eat each other up, and there's so many people vying for spotlight, right, that it's become really hard to be part of it and to listen to it and to engage in it. Every week, I'll find something on one of my Facebook paranormal groups that'll be saying, and somebody had a problem with Becky, oh, and Becky did this, mm-hmm, or Roberta did that, or James did that, or, you know, and you find all this gossip, and I just don't want to hear it. To me, that degrades any kind of professionalism in the field.
It's actually, Scotty, it's actually really embarrassing.
It is.
And right now, it is at the, since I've been in this field and since I have networked the way I've networked, it is probably the worst right now as we speak as any other time I've ever witnessed. It is really bad. And the funny thing is that they do it publicly. They just like you said, they are publicly out to bash other people. They fight over whose phone app is better. They lie on you know, past credibilities just to try to make themselves. Why can't we just be liked for who we are? And that's the problem, is that everybody's trying to be what they see on TV. And we've talked about this too, is what you see on TV is, it's not the reality of the world. It's entertainment. And I tell you, folks, you know, with these people, when they go to these spots to film, they have to do a lot of work to come up with 42 minutes of material. Sometimes they're there for multiple days just to get 42 minutes of material.
Right.
Sometimes you can fall asleep and take a nap during an investigation, but it's so hard. And we were talking about this on the last show, is that it's so hard to get people from the academic community to actually step forward in the paranormal field because of the public image it has.
That's right. Now, somebody told me, who is a very good man, told me, he said, Scotty, you do some good work. The only problem you have is that you are forever tainted by writing books about Nephilim, about reptilians, about doing paranormal, and that taints your work. And I said, my answer to that overall is, well, I don't care. I think people should take my work for what it's worth. And so that's a lot of the criticism I get, is because I'm in those fields at all. And I talk about stuff that people deem to be, well, it's alternative stuff. It's alternative science. It's alternative history, alternative all of that. I even have people criticize me because I believe Moses was a real man. And, how can you believe that? And, you know, we get that all the time. So, the critics are going to be out there, and they're out there really to show up the fact that they are good critics and they are watchdogs at the gate.
Well, they're critics to their own belief. Now, we call it alternative studies, but is it really alternative? It's alternative to what we are taught in schools. It's alternative. But, Scotty, you know this more than I do, is the more you learn within our history, within our country, within our governments, within our politics, your stomach turns. And what is the reality? What were we taught was actually legitimate compared to what was the real history? What was the truth? And I think that's why I admire you and John so much, is you guys are constantly searching. So if somebody's going to ridicule you for your beliefs and your hard work, your dedication to what you do, then it's just a character of them. It's a character of their judgment. It's bad judgment. Everybody should appreciate everybody's work, because there are answers out there, and the answers that we think we know sometimes aren't necessarily
right.
The answers. And John needs
Rocky,
to leave you alone.
Hey, Rocky, talk for a minute. I'm going to go mute. I've got Travis Walton calling, so you hang on.
Right.
You keep talking.
I'll come up with something to talk, but that's usually not a problem until I'm put on the spot. But, no, that's you know, we were talking about this on the last show, and I'm not a big conspiracy theory guy, but there is a difference between conspiracy theory and people that are searching for the truth. There are conspiracy theorists out there where everything is a conspiracy. It's the government. It's the FBI. It's the CIA. It's the end of the world. It's a prophecy, whatever it is. But then there's people out there that are seeking truth. Now, I've been interviewing people. This one lady, she was an ex-CIA agent, and she was involved in 9/11. And I've kept my distance from 9/11 for numerous reasons, but I find myself becoming more and more drawn to it because there's too many cards to the deck that just really make me scratch my head. And I know it's a sensitive subject to a lot of people, but if you really start looking back, and I'm going far back now, even prior to 9/11, the involvement of the people who we trust to run our country, the people that we trust to run our politics, aren't who they seem to be. And we go as far back as the World War II. So when we are called alternative scientists or alternative students to what our research is, I don't think that's alternative. And sometimes I truly believe that us as humans, we are the paranormal individuals compared to this universe, because I don't think we've even scratched the surface of what's real.
Well,
I
also tend to have a belief that sorry about that. That, by the way, that was Travis Walton. He is running about a half an hour late, so he may not be on with us for almost a half an hour or 35 minutes. So, folks, Rocky and I will keep you entertained. But don't go away and stay with us. And Travis will be here as soon as he gets in. He's going to message us so we can call him and get him on the line.
I'm just glad you're back, man.
Oh, why, thank you. That was like one of these radio shows where John was, he and I were talking, and it was 1 minute to the show, and then we tried to connect him for the show, and he was gone. And his internet just dropped, Egyptian internet. I ended up, I can't remember if we ever got him on for the later. No, I don't think we got him for the rest of the night.
Nope.
But that first half hour before the guest, I just had to, you just turn the on button on and you just keep talking. Yeah, Travis is going to be a little late, but I was also going to say about, I may have lost my train of thought about what you were talking about of the paranormal when I cut in on you.
Well,
there.
No, alternative studies, all, you know, how some people consider your work to be non-professional because it's in the alternative field compared to what their belief is. But yet they have not experienced or seen what you have seen in this field. They have not put their feet in the sand you have put your feet in. They have not done the research biblically or in any other field that you have. So who are they to judge your work because it goes against their own belief?
Or if they have done the research And they are qualified to make some comments. They are people who have their own biases that they bring to the table. I just wrote a big review on the movie Exodus. It's a little late in coming. I didn't really review every little aspect of the movie, but I reviewed the historical aspects of the movie because they made me absolutely insane. I loved the film. As a standalone movie, it was eye candy. It was pretty. It was impressive. Especially I love the digital flyovers of ancient Memphis. I mean, what a cool looking CG graphics they had. And the parting of the Red Sea was worth the 2.5 hours to get you there. I had a big problem with the history. And I wrote in that article, I said, now for all future critics of this critique, I said, this is not an exhaustive presentation of the facts. This is an article reviewing the movie for its historical fodder. I said, so enjoy this. And, you know, basically my word isn't the final word on any of this. It's just another apple on the cart. If John writes an article on the same thing, well, we were just on an interview talking about Exodus Reality yesterday. And we present two very different views of the same story that are so very close to each other on the time scale and have some of the same some of the similarities between the stories that it's an interesting topic altogether. But John is not someone, we both are invested in our theories, but neither of us are so invested that we don't have time for somebody else's theory, unless it's just way out there and it's wacky. You know, people who say Akhenaten was Moses, don't have time for you. Sorry. It just doesn't fit. And those who say Ramesses II, like in the Ten Commandments, the animated Prince of Egypt, the new movie, Ramesses II was about 150 to 200 years too late, and there's too much history to set that record straight. And if you think the Exodus didn't, I know the show isn't about the Exodus. If you think it didn't happen, you're wrong. Just because, and Rocky, maybe this fits a little bit into the criticism and taking things listening to the critics and looking at the sincerity of things. The Exodus story happened. There is too much evidence to controvert the fact that the event took place. We just don't know all the details about the event, although more and more and more of them are coming out. This is something that people will discount, just like they do paranormal, just like they do ufology, abduction, things like that. People will discount these things because, especially with the Exodus story, because it's found in a book of faith. And as John and I said in the book, if you discounted every historical event because it was wrapped around some culture's religious texts, you're going to lose just most of what you have.
Well, and you know, we're experiencing an exodus right now, like we talked about last Thursday on the show. Why couldn't it happen back then? We're experiencing it now. We see it happen all the time.
We do.
We see large groups of people fleeing from one country to another, fleeing from whatever they're fleeing from. Like we were just talking about the whole Italian thing, and
right.
So how could that not be real? What is the skeptic's argument? Stated because you said it came from
one of the arguments is that, well, if there were that many people migrating, they were going to leave a trace. Well, keep in mind the migration from Egypt into the Sinai was something that happened over a very short period of time. They cut a swath. They would have cut a swath. By some estimations in the biblical numbers, it was like 2 million people, 2.5 million people. I think those numbers are very skewed. But I think there were considerably less people than that. And, of course, they're wandering and, you know, who knows what has happened to the geography over the years. They traveled on the trade route, which is well traveled, the Wadi Tumulat, all of this stuff. So without getting into a critique of all of that, that's some of the criticism that comes up. And also that, well, Moses, there's no proof the man ever existed. Well, no, there isn't really proof that he existed. But there are plausibilities that exist, either via firsthand or secondhand archaeological data. And by secondhand, I just mean that it's indirect. It establishes the plausibility. So having said that, I think we're up on our break, Rocky.
We are.
So let's go out to break. And, folks, we would be bringing Travis Walton in right after the break. He's going to be just a little late, so you stay tuned with us. This is Scotty Roberts, and Dr. John Ward, that's me.
That's me.
Is over there in Egypt. He is listening.
He is
to the
listening.
Show. I think he's listening through the app on his phone, but
I can
he cannot
it.
Connect to the broadcast. So he's over there. Say hello to John. John, say hi to the folks. Hello. And Rocky, thanks for filling in for John at the last minute. Folks, we'll be right back in just a couple of minutes.
It's a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
The ancient pre-Celtic culture of Ireland left their legacy in the standing stones and mystic places of the Emerald Isle. This June 12 through 23, come to Ireland with history trippers Scotty Roberts and John Ward, Barry Fitzgerald of Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks and James Swagger, as they take you on an off-the-beaten-path tour of Ireland's ancient megaliths, castles, and sacred places. There is so much more to Ireland than the Blarney Stone and Guinness. Get off the well-paved road and into the mysterious, haunted, thin places of Ireland with the guides who can take you there. We have 15 seats available and they are already starting to book up. So go to exodusreality.com and get your place reserved today. That's exodusreality.com or call 651-468-8115. Come with us to Ireland.
Hello, my name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm a boxer and a Guinness drinker. Now, it's come to my attention that you lads in America only drink Guinness on special occasions. So let me tell you about this special occasion that finds me drinking a pint of Guinness. I was fighting Michael the Hammer Halleck when the referee stopped the fight in the fourth round due to excessive bleeding. As the referee led poor Hammer, covered in blood, to his corner, all I could think about was I was going to win for the first time in 57 professional fights. However, the referee soon made the discovery that it was my blood covering old Hammer. Now, what can I say? I'm a bleeder by nature. Now, you might be thinking, oh, in 57 is not much of a special occasion. And that's my point exactly. You can drink Guinness any day. Sure, it's dark, but it drinks smooth and easy. You may even find it refreshes your spirit. So don't be so precious with your pints. Grab a Guinness, because it's good to drink.
Guinness Stout, imported by Guinness Fast Import Company, Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, and if you think the Irish only bleed Kelly Green, just come to one of my fights.
When we make Beyond Natural dry dog and cat foods, we start with real meat as the first ingredient. We leave out corn, wheat, and soy. And we own where our dry food is made. 100%. Can other brands say all that? For nutrition you can trust and your pet will enjoy. Does your food go beyond? Learn more at PurinaBeyond.com.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to ScottAllenRoberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, AllenRoberts.com to take a look at his online portfolio of work or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
The fourth annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields, from ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
Here we are. We are back bringing you through the haze of confusion and hopefully bringing you to a place where you can make qualified, intelligent decisions on your own about the things that we present to you here on this program. Everything from archaeology, ancient origins, to ufology, abduction experiences, ghosts, all of that kind of thing. And I wish we had John Ward here with us tonight. He is able to chat with me a little bit on Facebook via his phone, but he cannot connect to the radio broadcast. And so he's over there in Egypt. As I mentioned, he just found out yesterday through his people it was their last day on their site at Gebel El Silsila for their season. They were there for, I believe, 8 or 9 weeks this time. And he got word back from the people back at his house in Luxor that the sandstorm had hit his home. I don't know what kind of devastation. I haven't talked to John since that conversation until just now. And he had said, and John, if you're listening, maybe throw me some tidbits of information. They said his house was full of sand. And that his internet was probably down. It was unlivable at the moment, so they're doing some cleaning up. And he is down the dirt road past the canal by the braying donkeys and the camel compound and the barking dogs and the running children. There is a small hotel, and that's where he's holed up. He is able to just connect via his phone, not internet, so he's not here with us, but he's over there in spirit, and he can talk with us over here, and not over the radio, of course, but he'll pass on some.
Do you ever messages. Realize talking to John in Egypt is almost like talking to a spirit box, because you kind of get the, but.
Sometimes. He gets sometimes so he'll be talking, and he'll say, brother, I have this, sentiment. That's what he sounds like sometimes when he's got him over in it. The Egyptian internet is a bit steam run, I think. And if somebody's not there stoking the steam engine late at night, then the radio broadcast from his end kind of falls apart. John says that his house is full of sand and Abdullah is now there cleaning. That's John's situation, folks. Wish him the best. It is now about 4:38 in the morning, Egypt time, Monday. And he's hopefully going to get his house shoveled out and didn't lose too many of his artifacts and his belongings and his books and things like that. So we'll see how things turned out for him.
So, Scotty, let me ask you something. I ran across an old video that I watched a very long time ago, and this supposed video, it's actually audio. It was from a team of researchers, and they were in, it wasn't Russia, but it was somewhere around Russia. And what they were doing is they were taking Earth core samples. And
yeah.
What happened was, is this, the drill that they're using,
yes.
I guess, they thought that it broke. They thought that the drill had broke when they were digging. They're really deep. And so they pulled the drill up, and to find out that it didn't break, what they realized was that they broke into, I guess, like a big hole or a big tavern or a big cave or something very big. And they heard these funny noises. They heard it almost sounded like people screaming. And so what they did was they got a tape recorder. And this can be verified. It's actually a professor does give a statement on this.
Now, first of all, let me guess. You had someplace like the National Enquirer or the Daily Mail or whatever it is came out and said, screams from hell heard from hole in Africa.
Well, kind of.
Oh.
But it wasn't from an Enquirer or something. This was, where did I see the article that caught my interest to make me go listen to the audio? But that's kind of what it was. They said it was the hole to hell. It was, they picked up the voices of hell. Now, the first thing I would think of is, you know, it's Earth. If it's in a cave, there's going to be a lot of wind or a breeze, or there's going to be a draft. There's going to be rocks. There's going to be edges. It's going to make whistles and all types of noises.
Depends on how deep it is. If they've gone very, very deep on this thing, what are they going to pick up in a cave? Unless, well, I suppose it has exits somewhere, so you're going to have wind coming through there. Who knows? By the way, John just said hollow Earth. Now, this whole hell thing, too, hell, if that's a literal place, I rather doubt it's in the core of the Earth.
Well, they weren't that far down. No way can they drill that far down, can they? They can't drill that far down.
No, no. Because they drill with these things that are about, what, 8 inches in diameter, right, and they drill core samples out. I think they can go down pretty deep, but they can't go that far. I don't know what the limit is. I'm guessing. I've seen some things where they're drilling for oil, or archaeologists are drilling for core samples, geologists, I mean, and they're ending up going down 100 feet and things like that. And that seems a long way to be shooting a drill, and they just keep adding attachments and pushing it down further and further. And what if you get it stuck and it snaps off and you've lost all that equipment? That would toast me.
I'm sure that happens.
So I'm sure it does. And John is just being John over there in my chat room. So I'm going to ignore him for a minute. John, I'm ignoring you for a minute. You're distracting me from my professionalism. So I did want to bring up this thing about the Exodus again, just a little bit more, as long as we can, as long as we've got a couple of minutes to kill before Travis is here. This whole thing about the Exodus is that there are stories that are biblical stories that people want to discount simply because they're biblical stories. And I tend to believe in Rocky. I think this spans over into the paranormal and other areas in their own genre. But because it's a biblical story, people want to discount it because they say, well, that's just faith stories. It has nothing to do with real history. But I think there have been so many archaeological finds that verify so much of the history in the Old Testament. You don't have to buy the faith story or adhere to it. But the history that's there is fairly reliable. Now, you do run into things where you aren't certain about dates and things like that. Like in my version of our book, The Exodus Reality, I talk about how the Bible has this hinge pin date. 480 years, it says, since the Israelites left Egypt with Moses, the Exodus, is when Solomon dedicated the temple in Jerusalem. And this would be, archaeologically speaking, and some people dispute whether Solomon existed or not, Temple One. Archaeological terms, it was Temple One, and they've established that Temple One would have been built mid-10th century B.C. And they've come up with a median date of about 966 B.C., give or take, not tens or twenties or hundreds of years, but give or take 3 to 5 years in either direction. And so at 966, if you take that 480 years, and you subtract backwards, you end up at 1446 for a date of the Exodus, which you'd think from then, if that's a solid date, you'd have a pretty good idea. But there's still the chronologies of the kings kind of jump all over the place. So on the Egyptian end, it's a little tough. You have to grab one dating system and stick with it. But on the other end, you've got all the question of the 480 years. It says 480 years. Now, is that just simply 12 times 40. 40 was the number of judgment in the Old Testament, and 12 was the number associated with the tribes of Israel. And 12 times 40 is 480. Moses lived three periods of 40 years, making it 120 years. You've got all of that kind of stuff going on, and they were in the wilderness for 40 years after the Exodus. Things like that. Is it mathematically just rounded up to be spiritualized numbers, numerological dating, or were those actual dates? We don't know for sure. But if you use that, you do end up in some pretty solid areas, for at least establishing my end of the theory. John's is completely different than mine. It's two generations later. But there was something I wanted to mention. And Rocky, if you want to take this in a different direction, you go right ahead. So
John is being very distracting right now. I think he wants attention.
I think he does. He's being very distracting. He's taking me to task for things I'm saying. And since he's not here, I'll just turn my screen
That's
off.
That's what he said. He says, we were not there, so we will
we
never
don't,
know.
We weren't there. We don't know. Yes.
I'm sorry.
And I just say, Sonnen ate a hapu sandwich and became Moses. Here's something very interesting, a little interesting fact that I brought out in this article and in the book, and trying to establish the date of the Exodus. was, if you all remember, and you all went to Sunday school, you remember Joseph, and Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. You know, Joseph was one of the sons of Jacob, who was also known as Israel, and his 12 sons, and they were all jealous of Joseph in the story, and they throw him in a pit, and they sell him into slavery, and Joseph goes to, ends up in Egypt in slavery, ends up in prison, all of these things. You know, he's just the innocent kid that kept getting into trouble. He eventually is raised to great power by interpreting the dreams of the Egyptian pharaoh. Now, the big question here is, why would a pharaoh take a guy, a kid, basically, who was a Bedouin Canaanite, and elevate him to high status? Is it just because he interpreted a dream? Would that dream be enough to elevate a slave or a prisoner to high status in Egypt? And eventually, according to the biblical story, Joseph became the Grand Vizier, which is known as the Pharaoh in the place of Pharaoh. Great power. And of course, in the story, you know, 20 years have passed, and his brothers come from Canaan, and they're begging grazing land, and that's how the story goes. And they have to meet in front of Joseph to get permission, and they don't recognize him, but he recognizes them. He's been gone from their lives for 20 years. So there's all these hijinks that go on, and little story, and what sound almost like fictional narrative that's added to the story. Joseph grants them land. He reveals who he is, and they grant him land, and they have to go to the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh has to approve it. And Joseph says something like this. He says, "Now, when you go to Pharaoh," he said, "tell him that you've been shepherds from the days of your youth and that you are still shepherds now. Tell him that because the Egyptians hate shepherds." And that's all he said. And then they go before Pharaoh. And I thought, now, wait a minute. Why is he telling his brothers to go before the Egyptian Pharaoh and tell them they're shepherds when the Egyptians hate shepherds? I kind of figured this out. And I think the dating system all works. And I believe that Joseph was elevated to a great position under the Hyksos rulers. They ruled for 110 years. And the Hyksos were, for 800 years, who the Egyptians called the Asiatics, had moved from the Canaanite region and the Syrian region, the Mesopotamian region, into the Nile Delta to use the grazing land. This had gone on for 800 years. And the scribes in Egypt referred to them as the Asiatics coming to beg water and fertile grazing ground. And these Asiatics that came in, they eventually worked themselves into government, I think the civic government and so on, and eventually they took over the northern throne of Egypt, and they divided the kingdom. This was the 110-year, really 108-year period of the divided kingdom in Egypt. And in the north, or lower Egypt, it was the Hyksos rulers. And in the south were the Egyptian rulers in Memphis. In Thebes, which is today, current-day Luxor. And I believe that Joseph was elevated to great status because he was one of them. He was from the Canaanite region, and they elevated him. And then when his brothers came, they told him they were shepherds. The Egyptians hate the shepherds, but this Pharaoh didn't. Why? Because he wasn't an Egyptian. He was one of them. And Hyksos in the Egyptian literally translated, they used to think it was just shepherding kings, the kings from the shepherding lands, and they've kind of pared that down to just the kings from foreign lands. And these were the people that I believe were in ruling power in the north of Egypt, and this is why Joseph was elevated to power. He's kinfolk. and this is why they told him that we're shepherds, when the Egyptians hated shepherds, because these guys are the shepherding kings. And then after 110 years, after all this is established and done, and it says in the biblical account that Joseph and his brothers and that generation all died off, that a new pharaoh came to the throne who had no regard for Joseph, and he slapped the Israelites into bondage. And there's always a big question about, well, were they really slaves there? And if indeed this was the Hyksos period, and Amos the First, the pharaoh of Egypt, came in and vanquished the Hyksos and reunited the kingdom of Egypt, what would he have done with the remnants of those people? According to the biblical account, he says, "We will put them in hard bondage, lest they rejoin our enemies and retake our country from us," is what the biblical account says. This is what the pharaoh was doing. I don't think it was an act of cruelty. I think it was an act of a responsible pharaoh of his nation. And he put these people, I think Israelites, as well as many other people, groups from that region that were remnants of these Hyksos, if they didn't flee and get out or die, they were slapped into bondage. It was the whole thing of keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And he did that to prevent them from reuniting and taking over the country. So there's some. This is what we talk about when we talk about plausibility in some of these accounts, is that you start to look at history and you can see that there are plausible things that happen that make sense and make the story make plausible sense. Now, whether Joseph actually lived, whether Moses actually lived, we don't know. John takes a position that Moses was more of an archetype through Amenhotep, son of Hapu, the grand vizier and the high priest under Amenhotep III. And which is just an 80-year difference in the same royal house.
So John believes that Joseph actually existed?
I don't think he believes Joseph existed. I don't want to speak for him, but I think John is, and I say this without teasing him about it or jabbing at him, John's a biblical minimalist. I think he will find that he thinks that the events in the Bible, that there's efficacious history there, but that there's a lot of fiction put in for the faith stories. And this is what you have to decipher as you're going through all of this stuff, is what's fact and what's fiction. What is there evidence to support and what is there evidence to say it just didn't happen that way? And I was talking to Dr. Charles Ayling just the other day. He was my seminary professor. He is the chair of history at the University of Northwestern, as well as the president of the Near Middle East Archaeological Society. And he said that, he says some of these people that are out there try to discount so many of these facts in the Bible and the facts surrounding the Israelite conquest and the Exodus. And he says he actually made a case for there's one archaeologist. He calls himself a rogue archaeologist, and he's written several books on the Exodus. Charles Ayling didn't speak too highly of him, and he said, he's actually tried to disprove and claim that the Shishunk of the Bible was not the Pharaoh Shishak, which is, we talked about how all those things align, and he said it's just ridiculous. He says the facts are just there, and they're there for the taking and they're for the gleaning. So it's interesting stuff.
Do you think biblically speaking, do you think the Bible has a lot more ties with ancient Egypt than people realize?
I think it really does. I think most of your Israelites that came out of bondage in Egypt, that these were people who were very Egyptianized. Keep in mind, the Israelites, they were not Jews. That's a misnomer, because the Jewish religion didn't exist as a codified religion at that time. Judaism was not codified until Moses codified it himself after the Exodus and created the religion, which is very much all based on Egyptian theology, Mesopotamian theology, Sinaitic theology. He put things together and borrowed a lot of information from the surrounding cultures and things he would have learned as a younger man in Egypt. And who knows what all he picked up during the 40 years he's supposed to have been away from Egypt before the Exodus. I do believe that the Israelites, when it came to the Exodus, there was probably a very small remnant of people that worshipped in any kind of what you could call a Judaic fashion. Did they all worship Jehovah God, or were they integrated with the Egyptian people? Because remember, when they came to the mountain, and Moses goes up into the mountain, and they tell Aaron, build us a god. And what do they have him build? A golden calf. That golden calf was none other than the Egyptian goddess Hathor. And they're John and I both believe that the holy mountain was Serebet El Chedim, which was the mountain dedicated to Hathor. Her temple was at the top of the mountain, a priesthood dedicated up there, and she was the patron goddess of the miners who worked in all of the mountains around that region. I believe there's just lots of little facts that point to the fact that these people, though Israelite by blood, were probably not as pure-blooded by the time as that came. I think they would think there was some integration with other tribes. But then again, the other flip side of that is that you may not have had Egyptians that wanted to have anything to do with integrating with the Israelites. If they were indeed a labor force, They may have been very looked down on. But there may have been interbreeding between the Canaanite tribes that were still there, the remnants of the Hyksos. Whatever it was, I think you've got a people that were probably very Egyptianized. They knew Egyptian religion. They knew the Egyptian stories. They asked to have an Egyptian goddess built for them at the Holy Mountain. So all of these things tend to point to the fact that there's more there than meets the eye. There's more going on. There's more that we don't know, but I think that the story actually happened.
Well, John just said he supports your working hypothesis.
Oh, well, thank you, John. Thank you for supporting my working hypothesis. And he hasn't talked to me for about 20 minutes while I'm rambling on.
Because he's been blowing my phone up.
Nice. And, folks, we do have to tell you, we hope this is interesting for you. This isn't what we were going to talk about tonight. We're waiting for Travis Walton to arrive. He is on the road. And I wasn't going to make it back quite in time for when he was scheduled to be on. If you're joining us now late, Travis Walton is still coming on, and it should be hopefully before the top of the hour. We may be able to connect with him. If not, hopefully it'll be right after the top of the hour. But Travis will still be here. He was just running late from some travel he had done today. And he called me in the last segment and just said he was running late. So he is on the road, and hopefully he'll be here any minute now. So we're just kind of killing a little good time here over on Intrepid Radio. We have so many different things we could talk about tonight. You know, Rocky, we started talking about the paranormal, and I was on another radio interview in Great Britain today, and they actually had they couldn't call it up. But they had your recordings from the Fernhill House that we had presented on this show. And they knew all about that. And so we got to talk about that crazy event. Folks, you remember that, where we had the Big Bang, and we had the French guys talking to us in EVPs. We had the huffing sound and the you're welcome sound and all of that, all very, very much sounding like they were standing right in the very same room with us. Which apparently, I guess they were. That
story has become very popular within the community.
I'm starting to glean that.
Yeah.
Now, John, by the way, John just typed in. He said, "What a load of crap." John, you were there. You were the one. You were the. And folks, if you have never heard this story, John, if you listen to the recording, John is the one who says the naughty words. He yelled as we were running upstairs to the noise. John yells, "Get me out of this effing house!"
Scotty, I think for entertainment's sake, I think we should play it.
I think we should. If you've got it queued up there, folks, if you haven't heard this, we were sitting in the basement at the Fernhill House. You'll hear a little bit of talking at the beginning. That's a little spirit gut box where you're hearing different signals popping up. And I'm sitting on the stairs. John is sitting in front of me. Rocky's sitting on the floor, and on the kitchen upstairs from me, John had left his little tape recorder. And this is what picked up all of this, and we heard this noise from downstairs.
Explain the breathing part, too.
Oh, and there's a breathing part. You'll hear this toward, as it gets later in the clip, there's a huffing sound. And that's none of us. It starts off, and it sounds something. And then you'll hear, "Welcome," on the top of it. And that's all EVP. We didn't hear the huffing sound. We didn't hear the voice, none of that. So go ahead and, Rocky, when you're ready, let that roll. And you'll hear the bang at the beginning. And this thing was, by the way, was so loud, it shook the house.
Right.
And there was nothing that fell over. There was nothing in the house to make that noise. And we'll explain it a little bit in the minute we have after this.
All right, here we go.
Whoop. Oh, that's just the sound itself.
There we go.
Hello, thank you for the sound. What was that? Hello? Hello, is anyone here? Welcome. Hey, thank you.
It's pretty crazy,
man. That was a pretty crazy event. And you heard that big bang at the beginning. That we heard that.
We felt that.
What's that?
We felt that.
Oh, we felt that.
Yeah.
And we ran upstairs because it shook us all. We weren't ready to hear something like that. And there was nothing, folks. Believe me, we're not dumb as rocks. We went up there and we looked for every possible explanation for that bang, and there was nothing. It sounded from the basement. To me, I explained it as like a steel extension ladder being dropped onto the wood floor upstairs. And it just echoed through the whole house. It shook the whole house, and we went up there, nothing. There weren't any cupboards that could have slammed. There weren't any windows that could have slammed. There weren't any doors that could have slammed. We even tried replicating, and there was nothing we could get that was close to it. And then, of course, we get the huffing and the "you're welcome" after we thank you for that. And, B.T. James in the chat room says, "Got your attention." It sure did.
Yeah, we picked up the next 10 minutes after that, too, and I don't know what everybody's beliefs are that are listening, but the next 10 minutes after this, we picked up, it was like 18 Class A EVPs are saying, "John," one of them came through and said, "I did it." I mean, pretty crazy.
Yep, pretty crazy
stuff.
Something
manifested in a way that I have personally never in my life experienced.
And I've never experienced that before either. It was pretty crazy. John just sent me a picture, folks, and if you go look at John Ward's Facebook page, it says he's sat here listening to Intrepid Radio and Scotty's lame theories on Joseph. And he tagged Rocky Stucci, and he's got a picture of where he is. You'll see the Theban Mountains in the background. And he's over on the east bank of the Nile instead of the west bank where he lives. And so he's taking a hazy little picture, and you'll see the sun is coming up from the east and starting to shine on the Theban Mountains in the west. Gorgeous little picture. And on that note, we got to go out to break. We're a little over time, so we're going to head out to break, and hopefully we'll have Travis Walton with us after this break. So stay tuned and stand by. We will make it the best show we can possibly make it once we get Travis here. So stand by. We'll be right back.
You can take the boys out of the city, but you can never plug a dam in Denmark with your thumb. Intrepid Radio, with a haphazardly focused Scotty Roberts and the rollicking adventurous Dr. John Ward.
Sticking their fingers in the hole in the dike of humanity.
The 4th Annual Paradigm Symposium will again be bridging the gap in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this October 1st through the 4th. The Paradigm Symposiums were founded and exist to present you year after year with the very best thinkers in their fields. From ancient cosmology to ancient aliens, archaeology to esoterics, alternative history to the sciences that illuminate our understanding of who we are and why we're here. Randall Carlson, Richard Dolan, Peter Robbins, Rita Louise, John Ward, Micah Hanks, and Barry Fitzgerald, along with several other phenomenal names in their fields, will be presenting at the Paradigm Symposium 2015, held at the Crown Plaza Hotel, Mall of America, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Get your tickets now for what will be another amazing, inspiring Paradigm Symposium. For tickets, go to ParadigmSymposium.com or call 651-468-8115. Come to think, leave inspired.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
The ancient pre-Celtic culture of Ireland left their legacy in the standing stones and mystic places of the Emerald Isle. This June 12 through 23, Come to Ireland with history trippers Scotty Roberts and John Ward, Barry Fitzgerald of Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks and James Swagger, as they take you on an off-the-beaten-path tour of Ireland's ancient megaliths, castles, and sacred places. There is so much more to Ireland than the Blarney Stone and Guinness. Get off the well-paved road and into the mysterious, haunted, thin places of Ireland with the guides who can take you there. We have 15 seats available, and they are already starting to book up. So go to ExodusReality.com and get your place reserved today. That's ExodusReality.com or call 651-468-8115. Come with us to Ireland.
Hello, my name is Patrick Sullivan. I'm a boxer and a Guinness drinker. Now, it's come to my attention that you lads in America only drink Guinness on special occasions. So let me tell you about the special occasion that finds me drinking a pint of Guinness. I was fighting Michael the Hammer Halleck when the referee stopped the fight in the fourth round due to excessive bleeding. As the referee led poor Hammer, covered in blood, to his corner, all I could think about was I was going to win for the first time in 57 professional fights. However, the referee soon made the discovery that it was my blood covering old Hammer. And what can I say? I'm a bleeder by nature. Now, you might be thinking, oh, in 57's not much of a special occasion. And that's my point exactly. You can drink Guinness any day. Sure, it's dark, but it drinks smooth and easy. You may even find it refreshes your spirit. So don't be so precious with your pints. Grab a Guinness, because it's good to drink.
Guinness Stout, imported by Guinness Bass Import Company, Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, and if you think the Irish only bleed Kelly Green, just come to one of my fights.
Are you looking for a really awesome and amazing graphic designer? How about an illustrator or a photographer? This is Rainey Roberts, and I wanted to tell you how you can get my designer, illustrator husband, Scotty Roberts, to work for you on your project. Do you have an awesome self-published book but no cover, or even worse, a cover that really sucks? Do you need a kick-ass logo for your company or some f***ing awesome graphic designs for your ads or website? Then get in touch with my husband for the best awesome kick-ass design and illustration. He knows his stuff, and he's been at this for more years than I've been alive. Go to ScottAllenRoberts.com. That's Scott with two T's, ALANROBERTS.com, to take a look at his online portfolio of work, or call 651-468-8115. Now go out and kick some ass with some kick-ass graphic design.
Hire my dad, so he can take me to Disneyland.
Simultaneous broadcast from a hidden cornfield in Wisconsin and some time-forgotten holy of holies in the Theban Mountains of Luxor, Egypt. Intrepid Radio with Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward. Intelligent talk.
I got to tell you, Rocky, I love that intro. That is some of the music from Transformers. And it starts out with that almost Gregorian chant and builds into some noble, I don't think there were French horns in there, but man, that's good stuff.
Very good stuff.
And we are still absent Dr. John Ward. Man, just say hello to him over there in Egypt. Go look at his Facebook page. He's posted some pictures of the sun rising on the Theban Mountains right now, from the hotel where he is holed up. And we do have with us Travis Walton. He was running a little late, and we've got him for about a half an hour here, so we are going to make good use of our time. And, so I just want to hit it right off. Travis, welcome to the Intrepid Radio program.
Thanks for having me.
I sure appreciate your being here. I got to tell you, your story is something that fascinated me long before I met you. And, you and I met, if you remember, we met in Taos, New Mexico. At the, I can't remember the name of the conference, but it was a conference back in 2011. And, I got your book. I'm holding your book, Fire in the Sky, The Walton Experience, in my hand. And you signed it on October 24th, 2011 is when I picked this book up. Now, this book was written after the movie came out. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, it was after, you know, and that's why I was able to include so much material about, you know, the making of the movie.
Right. And it's a fascinating book, and your experience is fascinating because it's become one of those UFO abduction experiences that has, it's captivated people, and at the same time, it's led people to say, oh, it's a fraud. I wanted to ask you outright, most of the people listening know who you are, and they know a bit about the story. Can you give us, in just a couple of minutes, a brief recap, and then I want to get into some things with you here. So tell us the story. What happened back in 1975?
Well, I was working in the woods up in the mountains with a crew of six other loggers, and after a long day's work, we were heading home, and it was dark, and we saw this glowing object hovering near the road. I got out and went up to get a closer look, and I was hit by a blast of energy from that craft. And the crew saw this happen, and they immediately, I mean, it was so violent, so much more powerful than depicted in the movie, that they were telling each other, he's dead, you know. They argued whether it degraded me, and, you know, so they fled. And tried to get some help, and then decided they would have to come back to rescue me. And the biggest just how my horrible my corpse was going to look. But when they were unable to find me, they went to the sheriff to report it, and were met with a great deal of skepticism. The sheriff and his men could see that these guys had gone through something very traumatic. You know, some of them were still crying, but they thought it was probably this crazy cover story for a murder, that they had buried my body up there on the mountain somewhere, and they were just trying to cover up for my disappearance. Well, there was a 5-day manhunt went on, tracking dogs from the prison and another group of tracking dogs and helicopters and men on horseback and on foot. And the dogs were unable to find any trail leaving that clearing. And but during this time, the men were, you know, this accusation of murder against them grew to the point where the sheriff brought in the state police lie detector expert, the top man in the state, one of the best in the nation. And when the crew passed the test, the sheriff was really stumped. But it prompted the president of the American Polygraph Association to say, yeah, sure, polygraph isn't 100% accurate, but when you have six people passing tests on the same issue, the odds were over 1,000,000 to 1 that they were lying. And so, you know, it was just one accusation after another, and that was back when there were 6 tests. Now there's 16 or 17 past tests with connection with incident. And, you know, here recently I said, for those who have experienced it, no more proof is necessary. But for those who don't want to believe, no amount of proof is sufficient.
Well, this is something that Rocky and I were talking about in the first half hour, is there's so much of this that goes on in either your type of experience or ghost experiences, paranormal stuff, even in science, all different kinds of research where somebody is going to say, well, you had an experience, but that doesn't prove anything to me. We think you're a fraud or we think you're a fake. And I've always said it's interesting that an experience like you have, and please, nobody flip out when I say this, it's like the same kind of thing I've said about Moses when John and I wrote a book about Moses. And I said it's when Moses was at the burning bush, he was the only guy there. He was the only guy there, the only guy saw it, and the only guy who wrote it down. And yet it founded a faith. So people are going to say, well, you were the only guy there. You were the only guy who saw what you saw or experienced what you experienced, even though you have...
I wasn't the only guy.
But that's the difference. That's the difference. You had guys who saw it happen.
Yeah, and that's the difference. Dr. Harder made the point that if you had had 6 people come in and testify that they had witnessed a murder, that's an open and shut death penalty case without
right.
lie detector And somehow, when it involves something of this nature, you know, like I said, no amount of evidence is enough if you don't want to believe it.
Right.
You know, the skeptics, all they had to do is just throw them a bone. I mean, just toss out any explanation, even though it doesn't fit the facts of the case, and people latch onto that and say, oh, yeah, that saves me from having to believe that, you know, we're not alone in the universe. And,
right. How do some of these, the police that you work with, how do they view this case now, or how did they end up viewing this case when all was said and done?
Well, you know, the sheriff has always been, he hasn't been stridently skeptical, but he's always, you know, tried to present a skeptical point of view on camera. But I've been contacted by a number of his friends and relatives that say that privately he's much more believing, and he just doesn't want to do so publicly. And, you know, and he's an elected official and has...
Sure, sure.
Sheriff, he was a county supervisor, so I can understand in his circles he's in a difficult position.
Oh, absolutely. What has... there was a long period of time that you didn't say much about this event. While it became a famous case, it's something that you pretty much, it seems that you stayed away from it until a certain point, and you said, that's it, I'm going to break my silence on it. I'm going to start talking more about this.
Well, people come out with a particularly outrageous allegation. You know, it was bad enough, the stuff that was said at first, you know, that I had a transitory psychosis. I'd become temporarily insane and believed that this happened, but you know, I'd returned to my sanity, and it was just a hallucination. And then there was the theory that it was a drug hallucination. But, you know, I had a whole battery of psychiatric tests, and I had blood and urine samples to put through the county medical examiner's drug screen, which proved there was no drug in my body at all. And yet, as lame as that was, the claim that what I experienced was a hallucination. And I'm saying it's lame because six other people are not going to have the same exact hallucination.
Right.
People latched onto that and acted like this explains it. Oh, phew, you know, now we don't have to accept it.
Right. And that's the problem. And then this is something you had to deal with. And is that pretty much why you stayed away from making much public comment about it? What was it that finally got you to the point where you said, you know what? I'm going to say something about this myself.
Well, you know, I realized that my refusing to do the interview wasn't going to make the story go away. They'd still do it. It would just be a lot more negative. And, you know, there's all kinds of people trying to get their 15 minutes of fame by claiming to know something. And it was real easy to, you know, disprove those people if I spoke up. So I was just kind of dragged into doing it to defend myself.
Right, right, and to defend your position. I'm reading in your book here in at the beginning of Chapter 10, you said, in the opening of this book, I included a discussion of bias and the need for an open mind in judging the validity of mine and my coworkers' experience with the UFO. Due to the unique and incredible nature of that experience, I feel that many of the questions asked are perfectly justifiable and appropriate. But when the answers to those questions are arrived at without fair examination of all the evidence, I strenuously object. And this is where I think what you're talking about, the critics that would come out of the woodwork who didn't even know you, didn't have all the facts in hand, and yet they were still criticizing you because of what you were saying.
Oh, yeah. My foremost critic had us riding in a car instead of a truck. So skifty on the details that he could try to claim that the crew saw the planet Jupiter. I mean, this craft was a glowing disc, you know, less than 100 feet away. There's no mistaking what we saw.
And what prompted you? I always wanted to ask you this. What prompted you to get out of that truck? Rocky and I were talking. If it was John and Rocky and I, and we were out in the woods and we saw something, we would get out of the truck because we'd want to see it. But what prompted you to get out when all the rest of the guys were apparently not hip on that?
Well, it was just kind of an impulse, and I was kind of assuming it would take off before I got very close. But their alarm and, you know, my own, you know, kind of coming to my senses, I got slower the closer I got. And I kind of felt, embarrassed to turn around and go back, you know, after being so bold.
Right, right.
So, you know, but a couple of the guys said that it looked to them like I was under outside control. And I said, no, it felt to me like it was my own idea. But they say, well, if they can control you, they can make you think it's your own idea. But I really do think that it was my own idea. I didn't feel like I was under any control.
Sure.
It was just kind of the way I was back then, a little bit of a risk taker.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you feel that somebody in the chat room just said the UFO made him get out? Do you feel that, do you have any inkling as you look back on this, as you've recited these details hundreds of times over the years, that you were, in any sense, I don't want to sound flaky with this, but you were chosen to do that. So you were the one that had to get out of that car. They were directing something to you personally.
Well, I didn't feel that way. Some of the crew believes that, but, you know, I guess part of the reason I went with the accidental encounter kind of theory, because that meant it was less likely to happen again. But, yeah, I suppose they could have been laying for me, but I wouldn't know why.
Have you had any other experiences since then of any kind?
Well, my standard response to that is if it did, I wouldn't tell anybody. Uh-huh. There was something here February before last where I had a couple of witnesses with me. So, and actually, it turned out there was 20 other witnesses too.
I ask that because I'm sure you're familiar with Whitley Strieber. In talking with him, he said that he believed that this had been happening to him. He only remembered the event that took place when I think he was around 50 or something like that, but. Or 40 or 50, but in all of his hypnosis and things that he remembered, started remembering things that happened when he was a child, that this had been happening to him his whole life, and a lot of abductees have this same type of story. So I was just wondering if you'd ever gotten any of that kind of work done or research done or looked into that. Have you avoided that? Ever come up with anything like that?
Yeah, I've avoided that. You know, and I've, you know, heard a lot about the phenomena by osmosis, just by being out there, these kind of events and talking about it, but I really haven't thoroughly studied any other case. So, you know, in the book I said, you know, my biggest outrage was that people would pass judgment before they had the facts. So I didn't want to be guilty of that. I didn't want to say pro or con on any case. Unless I'd studied the case, and I just haven't taken the time to study any other case. I had my hands full of my own.
Well, sure. You seem to me to be a guy that's just like, hey, this happened to me, and I don't really care to know more about it from all everybody else's point of view or everything that's happened to everybody else. To me, that seemed to indicate there was a certain humility about it with you. Not to put words into your mouth, but a certain... credibility that was lacking in other stories like this I had heard. Nothing ever quite like this one, but other accounts that you hear. And so is this something that you have a quote on your website, and I think it's even in the book, where you just say, if I could do it all over again, I would never have gotten out of the truck.
Yeah. And, you know, if it had happened and there was a way – keep it to myself, and especially for, you know, if I could look into the future and see how it would affect my life, I wouldn't have said anything. You know, people congratulate me for having the courage to come forward, but, you know, I was dragged into it, and it was world news by the time I was returned.
Oh, man. So four or five days later, everybody knew about it already.
Yeah, there was crews from Japan and England in town by the time I was returned.
Now, how do you deal now with all, looking back on, I mean, my God, this is 30 years ago. This is almost 40 years ago when this happened. 40 years ago this year. So in the ensuing 40 years, your life has not been consumed, obviously, with this experience. But it's more and more in recent years since, I guess, the movie came out. And by the way, D.B. Sweeney played you in the movie. How'd you feel about D.B. Sweeney playing you in the movie?
Well, you know, of course, you know, I'm thinking, well, he doesn't look like me, but you know, I guess you know he's better than a lot of the other ones that were proposed. And I won't mention those actors, but
Tom Selleck. You know, I really was going for Tom Selleck, but they got D.B. Sweeney.
Well, actually, in Australia, they said in an article there that I resembled a forlorn Tom Selleck. And I've always wondered what in Australian vernacular forlorn meant.
perhaps even five-lorn. But, yes. Somebody in the chat room just asked, for those not familiar with the story, did Travis have any memory of what happened in the days he went missing? Now, we obviously have seen that portrayed in the movie. We don't know how much of that's fictionalized versus what you really recall. When you first came back, when you were first found, in the movie they depict you as being naked behind some tub at outside a closed gas station or something. And what actually happened when you came to your senses, so to speak, and you realized, hey, I'm back? Were you conscious of this the whole?
Closed.
Okay.
They did film a scene where the actor portraying me is naked, and he comes upon a couple in a car, and they're naked, and they start screaming, and I start screaming. But that never happened, and you know, thankfully, that was edited out. But I guess you could say the nudity was a metaphor for the, you know, torn open feeling that I had in the aftermath of such an experience. But
now, were you fully cognitive and conscious through this whole experience? And when you showed up, they say you were like in a state of shock or something like that. Did you forget anything at the time, or did you remember? You knew immediately what had happened, and you're back now.
Yeah, there was a conscious period that I remembered all of that even before the hypnosis, but I was so traumatized I couldn't hardly finish a sentence about it. And so the hypnosis was a technique to remove the fear, just enough to recount the memory. Of course, it didn't remove all the fear, but it was such an enormous improvement. I got quite a bit of relief from that. But it was quite traumatic just because of the circumstances. You know, a lot of people, when I describe the actual events, they think, I wouldn't be that terrified, you know. But to wake up in a strange place and think you've probably been injured, the pain made me think I was in serious trouble, physically, you know, in danger of dying or something. And then, you know, to feel this feeling of suffocation, that above all, the dim light, the cramped, the humid atmosphere, everything all combined together. But that feeling of suffocation is what pushed it over the limit. So when I turned and could finally focus my eyes enough to see these creatures standing there, you know, I think I just lost my mind with fear. I was completely, you know, hysterical. But, you know, these people that say I would just stay calm and ask good questions and comport myself more appropriately. As a
yes.
Man. From Earth, you know, and maybe pick up a souvenir and leave. They just don't understand, you know, the circumstances of you know, coming to. And
right. Well, yeah, why didn't you pick up a souvenir? Why didn't you ask them to take you to their leader and so on? I understand. I get that. So now you've got, as I mentioned, 40 years of reflection on this. Where are you now with all this? Is this just like a surreal memory? Is it like you seem to be indicating the way you're talking that this is just a thing that happened to me, rather than I was horrified and it's changed my life forever. How have you dealt with it
over the years? For a long time, you know, just to talk about it, and that's part of my reluctance to do the interviews, was that I was reliving it to talk about it, and I was re-experiencing that level of fear. You know, I'd just be drained after I finished telling it, but In recent years, I've come to realize that this was probably not something where they were just trying to, you know, do experiments or torture me or something. That they were probably forced to take me aboard because I was foolish enough to get close enough to get myself hurt, and they just took me aboard to revive me.
So
realizing that, you know, I'm the one that caused it, and they were really just trying to help, has really changed my whole, the whole feeling I get when I talk about it.
Now, that's very interesting. I've never heard that perspective on that before. And how do you feel about it now? Is it just, once again, a faded memory, or is it something that's,
I'm this guy.
You know?
Rather than recounting my recounting, I really do go back there in memory. But more and more lately, I've been trying to connect my present understanding of it and separate it from that fear reaction that I had back then, to the point where, previously I'd accepted the term abduction, but it's actually more accurate to say ambulance call, you know. The nearest hospital was over an hour away, and, you know, none of the crew knew CPR, and, you know, if it was as simple as cardiac arrest, then it could have been something far worse.
Sure. Now, do you think that's what happened to you on the moment when you got out and got too close? Do you think it was something physically happened to you? You say they took you on board to save your life is almost what you're saying now. Was there evidence of anything that had happened to you of that nature?
Yeah, because, you know, the blast of energy came at the instant that I was closest to the surface of the craft. And I think this field that you could kind of sense building up, even the guys in the truck said it seemed like something was about to happen. I think it was an electrical charge that jumped to brown through me.
Oh, you know, John Ward is asking, and we've only got you for a few more minutes here, and I want to ask this. John Ward over there in Egypt, who would normally be here and is not with us tonight, he said, how do you feel about your mortality right now?
Well, that's an odd question. What do you mean?
How do you feel about dying? How do you feel about, where is your, I would ask it almost this way. And I would almost add to this spirituality. What has this done for you regarding God, regarding spirituality? John just said, do you feel you'll return in some way as if you've been chosen or something, John says. Do you feel anything like that?
I don't like to be so presumptuous. I think that might be kind of arrogant, but, you know, as far as, you know, some of the opposition that I got was from people who felt that it was some kind of a contradiction to their religious views. But, you know, I've had individuals from every religion express one side and the other that would say, you know, even Islamic people say, you know, this coincides with our religion as often as people say, oh, this can't be true. This contradicts my religion.
Right.
So it's kind of odd. And to the point where I said, you know, there's like 7 billion different religions on Earth.
Something like that. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Sure. What has this done for you in that respect?
Well, I've never, you know, I've become less religious and more spiritual. You know, I don't, you know, think that my views really fit exactly into any particular religion, although it fits into all of them to a degree. So, you know, it's kind of a personal thing. I'm one of those 7 billion.
Right. And what has this done to your view of the universe?
Well, it's certainly broadened my perspective. And, you know, I think that this new perspective has made me realize that all these know-it-all, you know, quasi-scientific people who say, oh, no, this could never be, those are the kooks.
Yeah.
The flat earthers are the people who say there could be no life elsewhere in the world, universe, and even if it did exist, they could never find us. Well, you know, we've got the Hubble telescope that has identified, you know,
tens of
other stars that, you know,
right,
they can even know whether they're life supporting or not. So if with our relatively primitive technology, we can see where they are probably at, certainly them being millions of years ahead of us could know exactly where we're at.
So has this whole experience left you now, at the age you are at now, 40 years in retrospect, you're looking at what you've got left. Has this changed you in a way that you would say this has changed my whole outlook on life, my whole outlook
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it derailed my life as far as, you know, what I could do with it, you know, and career choices and that sort of thing. My perspective, you know, my faith in the institutions around me, you know, all of that's changed dramatically. And it grows, you know, it continues. I mean, I'm continuing, even at this late date, to discover new things about the incident and come to a better understanding of it.
Well, that's got to leave you with that feeling of, I know, religiously, it's got to have changed you, as you said. It changes your outlook because you personally, having experienced what you experienced, say, this has expanded my universe in ways that none of us will ever imagine and maybe never want to imagine. So let's shift gears here dramatically. Since we've only got you a couple minutes now, you have a new documentary that's out. And by the way, so folks know, you're going to be speaking and presenting at the Paradigm Symposium this October, the 1st through the 4th. And that is here in Minneapolis. And folks, you can go to ParadigmSymposium.com and get your tickets. But you're going to be here, and Peter Robbins is going to be here as well, who is one of the producers on the new documentary, Travis. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, it's a very thorough, in-depth look at it in light of more recent perspectives, more recent research that's been done, some surprising discoveries, and a whole range of investigators and researchers in the field who have had years to look at the evidence. So it's much more developed than some of the earlier documentaries that were done.
Can you give us a little hint at what one of these new finds is all about?
Well, it was discovered that there were profound changes in the growth of the trees nearest to where the craft came down, and it's pretty detailed in terms of the evidence and the indisputable fact of it.
Well, that's and 40 years in reflection. You can now look at some of what has happened up there. So that's going to be very interesting to see. I haven't seen it yet. Peter sent me a copy, and I haven't gotten it yet. But as soon as I do, I'm going to take a peek at that, and I'm going to be looking forward to having you here at the Paradigm Symposium. How can people get a hold of you? Get a hold of your book? And by get a hold of you, I mean not call you at 2 a.m. and want to chat. But
well, I can be reached through my website, TravisWalton.com. I'm going to have a 40th anniversary conference in the town nearest where it happened, and that's at SkyfireSummit.com. And
that's kind of interesting. I didn't know you were going to have a summit. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, we've got a number of speakers coming and invited some celebrity guests that well, I won't say anything about that yet.
Sure. I understand. Well, I'm looking forward to having you here at the Paradigm Symposium, and you with Peter Robbins, and I know some other people that are going to be very interested in meeting you there. And so, Travis, I want to thank you very much for being here, taking time out of your busy night. Even though you were running a little bit behind, you still came in, and I appreciate that. And look forward to talking to you some more in the very near future. All right, brother. Thanks a lot. Good night. Folks, that was Travis Walton, and he gave his website out, and his website is TravisWalton.com, and you can see more about what he's doing. He wrote the book Fire in the Sky, The Walton Experience, the best documented case of alien abduction ever recorded. It's a very thick book, and it's well worth your few bucks to get it. And read all about this incident, and he is going to be at the Paradigm Symposium in October. If you would like to meet him personally, come and get your tickets. There's still tickets left for the Paradigm Symposium. Go to ParadigmSymposium.com, and you can meet him. Rocky.
You know, I was I got to say something, and I wanted to ask him, but I know we were really short on time, so I didn't want to disturb, but it would have to be really hard. I was really thinking about this, to be an experiencer, to actually have a real-life event and nobody believe you.
Oh, man. That's got to be a hard part. It's like I can almost imagine back to being a little kid when your dad said, what happened to your bike? Why is your bike mangled? And he said, well, a bear jumped out of the window. And then nobody would believe your story. Right. You know, I'm just making that up as I go. But you all know what we mean. If something traumatic happened to you and nobody wanted to buy his tale.
That's really unfortunate. I mean, to be prodded and you know, blood tests and psychological tests and evaluations and constant scrutiny, and it just... But I tell you, if this really did happen, that would be such an unfortunate circumstances to have to or want to share this with somebody and nobody to listen. And then to go all these years, and he did say that he's still trying to figure things out from what happened.
Yeah, and he said that there are things he just doesn't want to talk about certain aspects of it. It's really things I keep. He keeps close to the vest, I think.
I really liked your question about spirituality and the beliefs of the universe, and because you do think about that. What would change in your mind and your thoughts and your beliefs if you did experience something like this? And how would you live your life on a daily basis? And what would you question compared to what you believed all your life?
Right. If you had an experience like Travis had, or say even Whitley Strieber, who had his abduction experiences and has written extensively about it. And there are some people that aren't famous but have gone through the same types of things. How would you feel about life after that? How would you feel about if you knew if some craft picked you up and took you on board and conducted experiments on it and dropped you back off? And as Travis said, now this is interesting, I'd never heard that angle on that before. He said he believed that he was so close that it injured him and they took him on board to protect him and then put him back on the ground. That's an afterthought of his, I think, but in retrospect to all this, but it's how would that change you? You would be like the guy or the girl walking around that said, I've seen things that nobody else here has seen.
Right.
And I know things. And if somebody looks up at the sky and randomly says, gosh, I wonder if anything's out there. You go, yeah, it sure is. And it's like, you know, where other people can only guess. So.
And they don't make you absolutely think too that if you did have this experience and you really did see, cause he said that he saw them, then it would really make you think on how much play did they really have on our earth and how long have they been here?
That's a big question. Why don't we tackle that, Rocky, after a break? Let's take our – we blew right through the break here because we didn't want to cut Travis off. But you're listening to Intrepid Radio. Absent Dr. John Ward, me, Scotty Roberts, is here. Rocky Stucci filling in for John tonight. And we're going to cut out to break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Hang on.
Intrepid Radio is a lot like riding a two-humped camel. Just ask Dr. Ward. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
The ancient pre-Celtic culture of Ireland left their legacy in the standing stones and mystic places of the Emerald Isle. This June 12 through 23, come to Ireland with history trippers Scotty Roberts and John Ward, Barry Fitzgerald of Ghost Hunters International, Micah Hanks and James Swagger, as they take you on an off-the-beaten-path tour of Ireland's ancient megaliths, castles, and sacred places. There is so much more to Ireland than the Blarney Stone and Guinness. Get off the well-paved road and into the mysterious, haunted, thin places of Ireland with the guides who can take you there. We have 15 seats available and they are already starting to book up. So go to exodusreality.com and get your place reserved today. That's exodusreality.com or call 651-468-8115. Come with us to Ireland.
Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Baron Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
For the thousands of wounded warriors returning from battle, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to a civilian job. These extraordinary men and women bring more than just teamwork and inspiration to the workplace. They bring proven world-class job skills. And to ensure proper placement, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right job fit. Talented, skilled, and eager to get back to work, you have the opportunity to hire a seasoned veteran. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home, the brave.
Are you ready for some rollicking adventure? In Scotty Roberts' book, The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare, join Irish Rabbit, Tam O'Hare, and his young squirrel squire, Horatio McNutt, as they journey through Scotland of the mid-1500s seeking a small child who's been stolen by the fairy folk. Crafty raccoon pirates, conniving noble wolves, conflicted royal foxes, and self-serving religious badgers all stand in the way as their quest brings them headlong into high seas action and supernatural intrigue. The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare is in bookstores everywhere and at barnesandnoble.com. This hardcover, lushly illustrated chapter book is the first book in the Tam O'Hare series, so swash your buckle and prepare yourself for a historically rollicking, swaggeringly supernatural adventure. Visit TamO'Hare.com to learn more. You'll never trust a raccoon with a sword again.
Sticking their fingers in the hole of the dike of humanity, Scotty Roberts and Dr. John Ward.
Hey, folks. We're back. This is Scotty Roberts. Absolutely. Dr. John Ward. We've got just a few minutes left of the show here, a little less than 10 minutes. And Rocky Stucci is here with me tonight. How you doing over there, brother? What'd you think of that interview?
I'm sitting here asking Scotty all these questions during the break because, you know, the first question I asked Scotty is he believable? And he is, because look at some of the facts in the book. How many times has he been polygraphed? How many times have the people involved been polygraphed? They've all smoked the polygraph test. And it would be the biggest fear I would have is something did happen like this for me. The rest of my life, there would be something in the back of my mind worried if it's going to happen again.
Right. Now, here's something that's interesting. This is out of Travis's book. It's on page 356. It starts. And we're not near the end of the book here yet. He said the he's talking about the polygraph. And he said the irrelevant questions, which ask for name, residence, etc., are not listed here. Only asked in order to provide a yardstick of known truth, responses for comparison. Also, Duane initially took the known lie test, which showed him a strong responder. Some of the 14 relevant questions, the others were variations or sub-issues of these, on my brother's polygraph test were this. Question number 2, and he's got them listed 2 through 8 here. Did you participate in a hoax to pretend that Travis was missing? Do you believe that Travis participated in a hoax to pretend that he was missing? Do you know where Travis was located during the several days he was missing? Do you believe that Travis is sincere in describing his experience while he was missing? Would you lie to help Travis in this matter? Did Travis hide on the Kellett Ranch? Prior to November 5th, 1975, had you read a book on UFOs? Then Travis goes on to write, the examiner, George Pfeiffer, wrote in his report, quote, after a careful analysis of the polygrams produced along with the information gained during pre-test and post-test interviews, it's the opinion of this examiner that Duane Walton has answered all questions truthfully according to what he believes may to be the truth regarding this incident and has not attempted to be deceptive in any area. And this is repeated over and over and over again in this book about all these different polygraph tests, and Travis goes and interviews them all about all of this. So it was a very interesting case. Very interesting. Well, here, I'm just looking at another. We've got a few minutes left here. Testing was performed on Duane, that's his brother, and me by George Pfeiffer, a charter member of the Arizona Polygraph Association and a full member of the American Polygraph Association. He had been a detective sergeant with the Police Department of Miami, Florida. Pfeiffer's report. This was Pfeiffer's report. Mr. Travis Walton was given a polygraph examination at this office at 3 p.m. Friday the 7th, or I'm sorry, February 7th, 1976. The purpose of this examination was to determine the truth in his statements regarding a UFO incident that occurred on November 5th, 1975, and lasting until the early morning hours of November 11th, 1975, as reported by Travis. This examination was performed by using a Lafayette polygraph model number 76056-B. During the preset interview, it was determined that Travis Walton was well-rested and cooperative, was feeling physically fit, and preliminary tests indicated he was a suitable subject for the examination. A discussion was held, and we mutually designed questions for this examination. Prior to the examination, all questions were again reviewed with him. He agreed to answer all and signed the consent waiver form. Question formulation of the relevant-irrelevant type. Following is a list of the relevant questions used in this examination. Here's what they asked Travis. Are there approximately only 2 hours you recall during your experience? Answer, yes. Did you find yourself on a table inside a strange room? Yes. Did you see strange-looking beings inside the room? Yes. Have you been reasonably accurate in describing your experience? Yes. Did you conspire with another to perpetrate a hoax about this matter? No. Were you struck by a blue-green ray on the evening of November 5th, 1975? Yes. Since November 1st, 1975, have you used any illegal narcotic drugs? No. Before November 5th, 1975, were you a UFO buff? No. Have you been completely truthful with Mr. Lorazin in this matter? Yes. Did you see a UFO on the evening of November 6th, 1975? Yes. And then he goes on with his report. He says, it should be noted that questions number 9, 10, 11, 13, and 15 were used in this examination exactly as Mr. Travis Walton dictated them to this examiner. Mr. Walton was completely cooperative during this examination. There was some slight response regarding number 10, which was, were you struck by a blue-gray ray on the evening of November 5th, which he answered yes. He said there was a slight response regarding number 10. After the first chart was run, it was determined that Travis had not actually seen a blue-gray-green ray coming from the alleged UFO. He did see the area illuminated with a greenish light. So that was clarification. It came up kind of funny because, no, I didn't get it. I didn't see a blue-green ray. I saw a green light. After a very careful analysis of the polygrams produced, there are no areas left unresolved, and it is all the opinion of this examiner that Travis Walton has answered all questions in a manner that he himself is firmly convinced to be truthful regarding the incident commencing November 5th, 1975. George Pfeiffer, Jr., examiner. So that's right out of the book. So that was the examination that took place, and that was the examiner's opinion of Travis's answers to the question.
Oof.
So that can be some pretty intense stuff. And I know the movie, while it's fictional in many respects, as Travis said, he wasn't naked when he was set back down on the ground. He seemed a little intent on making that point very clear. I was not naked. So to me, he bears a certain, credibility. And, I find him to be a credible person. I met him face to face and looked him in the eye and talked to him, but he's seemed credible to me. And to me, that means a lot when it comes to all of this kind of thing, when you're asking those kinds of questions and, when you're trying to get his take on things. And, for me, jury is still out on all of this stuff. This is an experience that I can say, like the examiner, Rocky, that this is a guy who truly believes what happened to him happened.
Right.
And, but will people say that about you and I and John and the things we experience with you? Well, I can firmly believe that Scott and John and Rocky all believe that happened. Of course, we have tape recordings about things, but, so that's what makes Travis an interesting character to me. And it's an enduring story. And as he said, he was a normal guy that something very extraordinary happened to him, and it set him apart against other people out there.
Well, I must say I do look forward to meeting him in October.
Yes. And, folks, as we mentioned, he's going to be speaking at the Paradigm Symposium. We're going to get him when he's not worn out after a whole day of going back and forth across Arizona, visiting his son and so on. And so it was very cool that he still came on with us, and I really appreciate that. But if you have not gotten your tickets to the Paradigm Symposium, paradigmsymposium.com, go get your tickets. Travis is definitely going to be a headliner at the show along with 15 other speakers that we have. You can go to the website and see who's there. And Peter Robbins and the producer, the executive producer of the new documentary, Travis, is going to be with us at the Paradigm Symposium, and they're going to be showing the film there at the symposium if you haven't had a chance to see it by then.
Oh, they're showing the film there.
They're going to show the new film there.
Excellent.
And this is apparently one of the best documentaries, at least according to Travis and to Peter Robbins, who is here, who is also speaking at the Paradigm Symposium, one of the best documentaries ever made on the Travis Walton story. And so there you have it. Let you be the judge. You determine what you think about an incident like this. Determine what you think about what lays out there. Rocky, what do you think it would do to you, to your belief system, if something like this happened to you?
It would make me question a lot of things, but it would also validate a lot of things, too. But then it would really make me look back at history. It would make me look back at mankind. It would make me look back at, you know, how even some people talk about, you know, Egypt and the pyramids and UFOs. And, you know,
right.
Even biblically speaking, they talk, people believe that there's UFOs involved. I mean, it would make me question if that was really true.
Yes.
But then again, it would change everything. It would change the way I walk, the way I think, the way I talk. I'm not going to lie. It would change my personal beliefs of when it comes to who's God or what's God or who really created us. Are we just some kind of a little pet shop to somebody watching from outer space? It would make me question things really weird. And honestly, I hope I don't ever have to experience this.
Yeah. Yeah, me either. I never want to have to experience anything like this. John just, by the way, John Ward is still out there. And in the closing moments of the show, he just wants you to all know he was abducted by bunny rabbits.
That's believable.
That's John's input for the night.
Don't even
and
need
you know
a polygraph.
What? I believe him. Folks, thanks for listening tonight. It was a fun show. Rocky, thanks for filling in for
Absolutely.
John for being here. And appreciate it, brother.
You bet.
And we will be back on Thursday with the Situation Room. We've got some very interesting topics Rocky, John, and I are going to be discussing. And we'll be back here on Sunday of next week at the same time, 9 p.m. Central Time. We'll see you then. Thanks for joining us. Say goodnight, John. Good night.
I hope that you remember me. Steve Hart.